Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, let's start this evening at the very back of the book of Genesis, because there is a principle here that's going to kick in and play very heavily in the Joseph narrative that we're going to pick up tonight. Tonight we're going to look at Joseph's dreams and Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers and their evil intentions. And then Moses does a very odd thing in his writing that right in the middle of the Joseph story, he says, it was about this time that Judah left his brethren. And then he tells this whole story about Judah taking a wife and Judah having children and then his boys growing up and then one of his boys being killed by God and the next boy being killed. And so there's this whole other story. And then he jumps back to, oh yeah, now remember Joseph? You know, when we last saw him, he was in Potiphar's house. So we're going to get some Joseph and some Judah story tonight. But what you have to understand, the primary principle behind the entire Joseph narrative that Moses writes into this first of the five books that he's credited with in the Old Testament, is the principle that you find in chapter 50, verse 20. It's the very end of the book of Genesis. It's leading into the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus starts right out with, you know, there rose up a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. Genesis ends with Joseph. Well, at the end of Genesis, Moses takes the time to point out that God is fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant that lays at the heart of the whole Genesis book. The central issue of the book of Genesis is the Abrahamic covenant, and that God is going to keep covenant with this particular family, the descendants of Jacob, whose name has been changed to Israel, and that they're going to go into captivity. They're going to be there for 400 years. They're going to serve as slaves. They're going to come out with more substance than they went in with. They're going to come back to that very land that God promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. That means that all 12 of the tribes have to survive, and in particular, the descendants of Joseph have to survive, because throughout the book of Genesis, we've been seeing God picking and choosing the direction that the promise goes. And we've been talking about this whole seedology concept, that God picks the way that the seed is traveling going toward Christ. And so Joseph is going to play, and his two sons born in Egypt are going to play very prominently in the whole Abrahamic covenant scheme. And so you've got this situation where Joseph is hated by all his brothers, and his brothers are going to try to kill him. And then when Reuben steps in and says, no, don't kill him, they end up selling him into slavery. And when all of that happens, all this really terrible, evil stuff happens, heartbreaking stuff for Jacob, that his favorite son, the first son born by Rachel, that he's dead, and Jacob is convinced that he's dead. They even bring him back the coat of many colors and show it covered with blood and say, your beloved son, he's dead. Heartbreaking, heart-wrenching stuff. Well, as we continue through the Joseph narrative, and most of you know this story, eventually those self-same brothers are going to stand before Joseph when he is second only to Pharaoh in terms of power in Egypt. And God is going to bring a famine in Israel, which is going to drive these same brothers to Egypt. And when they get to Egypt, the man they have to stand in front of is Joseph. But they don't know it's Joseph because, of course, time has passed. He's in his splendor. He was probably wearing Egyptian makeup. He's surrounded by all the people and all the power. And so they have no idea this is the brother that they betrayed that they're standing in front of. Well, when it finally comes to light that they're dealing with the very same brother they had betrayed, they're, of course, afraid for their lives. He's second only to Pharaoh. He snaps his fingers. They're dead men. And he's put them through a whole series of tests by then to find out what kind of men they really are. Well, now they're standing in front of Joseph, and they're really hoping for some kind of mercy. And Joseph makes this really astounding statement. to really form this compatible notion of the apparent will of human beings and the evil they do, and the intention of God, and how God always wins out and his intentions always play out despite the evil that men do. People think that there is an intrinsic conflict between the holy, righteous will of God and the evil intentions of men. But the truth of the matter is, the God we're dealing with is so sovereign that he is able to work through the evil intentions of men in order to make his sovereign goodness occur. So in order to keep all 12 tribes of Israel alive in the famine, but also in order to bring those 12 brothers into Egypt so that the beginning of the captivity will happen when Exodus starts and there rises up a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And then the 400 years of captivity are going to ensue exactly like God said. God is working out precisely and exactly what he told Abraham he was going to do. But he's going to accomplish it through the evil intention and actions of evil, wicked men doing whatever they want to do. And they're going to do exactly what God said was the proof and evidence that this land belonged to Abraham and his descendants. You get all that? So Joseph gets all that and makes this statement. Let's start in verse 18. Then his brothers also came, and they fell down before him, and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." In other words, don't kill us. But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place?" In other words, if there's judgment to be had here, God's going to judge you. I'm not going to judge you here. And don't be afraid. As for you, verse 20, you meant evil against me. There's no question about the fact that their intention to kill him was nothing but evil. You meant evil against me, but simultaneously, the exact same act, the same intentions, but God meant it for good. So right there, you have a perfect encapsulation of what I mean when I talk about God's compatibilism, this idea that God's sovereign will and the actions of men are actually compatible. They're not in friction with each other. They're not working against each other. God is sovereign enough to use even the evil intentions of human beings to accomplish his ultimate good. What was the ultimate good? Joseph says, God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. The whole nation of Israel was kept alive because they worked evil to Joseph. And then God moved Joseph through Potiphar's house and back into prison and then interpreting dreams and into Pharaoh's court and then 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. All of that occurred so that then these brothers would come looking for food in the only place there was food. They'd come to Egypt, stand before their brother. He would say, "Don't be afraid. You definitely meant it for evil. God meant it for good to save many people alive. He's going to set them up in Goshen," and they become rulers in their own right in Egypt. And to this day in Egyptian history, there is this word Hyksos, which means shepherd kings. And it's not a word Egyptians like. Egyptians know that in their history, there is the history of being ruled by shepherd kings. And they don't like that notion because they were foreigners that ruled over them. And so the Israelites, the 12 tribes, for a while were rulers there with their brother Joseph. And then Exodus starts with, there rose up a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph. And there were so many Israelites in Egypt at that point that the Pharaoh realized, you know, if our enemies ever are in cahoots with the Israelites, they could very easily overthrow us. And so that Pharaoh works to bring the Israelites into captivity. Their 400 years of bondage starts, and God does exactly what God said God was going to do. But how did God do it? It all starts with Joseph saying, "I had a dream." And the rest of his brothers go, "Well, we hate you in your dream." And he says, "Well, I had another dream." And then his dad says, "No, now wait a minute. Now you're going a little too far with the whole dreaming thing." And then his brothers say, "Let's kill him." and evil starts. But between Joseph's dream and the end of Genesis, the sovereign hand of God is playing out to accomplish every minute detail of the Abrahamic covenant. Got that? Okay, that's the God we're dealing with. Now you can turn backwards to chapter 37. That's the God you're dealing with. Because sometimes in this life, bad stuff happens. Sometimes in this life, trouble occurs, and we are very quick to say, well, where's God in this? And so that's why it's really, really helpful to read those portions of the Bible where you see God working through really bad circumstances. I've said many, many times, and now we'll say yet again, I am the king of redundancy. I am the king of redundancy.
I get it.
One. It's the Department of Redundancy Department.
Could you say that again?
Did that get you? Could I say that again? I could say it again, but why would I? The single worst thing that ever happened in human history, death of Christ. The only innocent man who ever lived. The only holy, righteous man who ever lived. Pilate and Herod and the Gentiles and the Jews all got together to kill him. And then Luke writes in the book of Acts that they all got together and did whatever God's hand ordained would be done. And so they, of their own hatred and their own purpose, killed Christ. Worst thing that ever happened. And the whole rest of the New Testament says, best thing that ever happened, death of Christ. So compatible. God can move into terribly bad situations and work his ultimate good. And oftentimes we don't see the good, we don't understand the good until it's well past, till it's ancient history, and we can look back over the slope of our lives and see that that's the point at which God was beginning this work. Know what I mean? I can personally testify that I've had some bad stuff happen in my life. I don't think there's anybody here in the room that doesn't know what I'm talking about. Whether it was the surgery in 2001, which came completely out of left field, and then I ended up 2 weeks in the hospital in the intensive care trying to die. Bad time. Not fun. Lots of pain. But in the midst of that, I can look back on it now and I can see that that was the beginning of a work that God was working on me to get me ready for the next bad thing that was about to happen. It was Don Tyndall that pointed that out to me. He said, I think God knew that if he just blindsided you with what happened in 2003, it would have just destroyed you. So in 2001, he started prepping you and taking you through those kind of character-building exercises that culminated in the next series of bad things you had to go through. But in the midst of the worst of it, it was Elder Ward on the phone that said to me, always remember, Jim, that this is the process through which God is making you into the man you are going to become. That helped. I needed that. Well, now I have the advantage of time, and I can step back from the circumstances and step back from the crushing pain and just look at what happened and how God worked it out. And the truth of the matter is, I like who I became. I don't know how else to say that. But I became a better father. I genuinely believe I've become a better pastor. I know I've become a better biblical exegete. I look at the scripture differently. I see nuances in it now that I never saw before, because for a very long time it was an intellectual exercise. Now it's a very personal exercise. But I couldn't have gotten here now if I hadn't gone through what he took me through. But when I was going through it, I hated it because it was bad and it was hard and it was just awful. But did God get good out of it? Was he glorified through it? Is the end result a positive thing? Sure, yes. Did I know it at the time? No. I'm sure that when Joseph was laying in the pit, he was not thinking, well, this is all going to work out just fine. His brothers were planning to kill him. He gets sold into slavery. He's going to be accused of rape. He's going to end up in prison. I'm sure at that point he was not going, well, I am firmly in the hand of God's sovereign plan right now. It's only when he had the advantage of time and the aspect of being able to look back over all the events that he could conclude, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, to save many people alive. So the point of everything I've said so far tonight is, when you're going through the struggle, it's good to know that you're dealing with a God who is working through the circumstances of your life to produce his ultimate good. Because when Paul writes in Romans 8, all things work together for good to those that love God, who are the called according to his purpose, that must mean something. And when Paul says, all things work together for good according to God's purpose, well, that means all things. All these things are working for good. Even the bad stuff, even the difficult stuff, even the stuff that hurts, ultimately redounds to God's glory and God's ultimate good.
And Paul could speak from experience too, couldn't he?
Oh, couldn't he? Oh, absolutely. No matter how much I complain about turns and twists in my life, I've yet to take my first 39 lashes.
We'll remember, as the precious moments figurine reminds us, God's not finished with you yet.
I get all my theology from precious moments figurines. If it's not on a bumper sticker, a t-shirt, or a figurine, doggone it, I'm not interested. Chapter 37, verse 1. Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. This is the promised land. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him, and they could not speak to him on friendly terms. There's the situation. Family conflict. He's taking bad reports to dad about them. They're hating him. Nobody can speak peaceably to each other. There is conflict in the house. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, please listen to this dream which I had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in a field. Do you know what that means? You get long stalks of grain, and then you would bind it. You would tie it together in the middle. So basically it's standing almost like a urn-shaped or Coke bottle-shaped stacks of grain. So they're tying together all the sheaves, and the sheaves are all standing out in the field. And each of the sheaves standing in the field represents one of the brothers. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. And they all went, good dream, brother. Love you, mean it. No, they hated this idea, because clearly you don't even have to have a great interpretive mind to know what that means. Then his brother said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. In other words, it's bad enough he dreamed it, but they could think that, well, he's delusional. He has delusions of grandeur. He believes that all of us are going to bow down in front of him. But the worst part was, he told them. He went to them and said, hey, listen, I've had a dream. Hey, my sheaf stood up aright. You all bowed down to me. So they hated the dream, and they hated him for telling it. Now he had another dream, verse 9. And he related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." So who are the 11 stars?
His brothers,
because there's 12 altogether. So the 11 stars are the 12 brothers bowing down to him. But who's the sun and the moon?
Parents.
It's going to be the parents. The interpretation is going to make that clear. And he related it to his father and to his brothers in verse 10. And his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" So now even dad is upset with these dreams he's been having. Now, that typology of sun and moon and 12 stars shows up again later in the Bible. Anybody remember where? Say it, you know.
Revelation.
Shows up in Revelation, exactly. There is a woman with the sun and moon under her feet, 12 stars around her head. She's a woman in the wilderness, and she gives birth to Christ. And so she's a type of Israel. And so this typology established in Genesis is carried over later in the book of Revelation. So it's a very established typology, the sun, the moon, and the stars as being Israel. And his brothers were jealous of him, says verse 11. And his father kept the saying in mind. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." And he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me." So when Joseph left the house, the anticipation by dad was, he'll be back. He's going to come back and he's going to bring me a report. Also notice that all the brothers were out in the fields in Shechem, a distance away, taking care of the flocks. Joseph's at home with dad. So there's this very firm bond going on here between dad and Joseph. And dad says to Joseph, "Go check on your brothers and come back to me and tell me how they're doing." Joseph never comes back. That's the point. Joseph is going to find his brothers and report to dad. Dad's anticipating Joseph's return. Joseph never comes home. The next time Jacob ever sees Joseph is when Joseph is in Egypt sitting on Pharaoh's throne. Verse 14, he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of your flock and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They have moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. When they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." These are not good guys. These are the 11 progenitors of 11 of the 12 tribes of Israel, God's chosen people. And they're not starting out well. The first generation is already plotting murder together. Aren't you glad that God deals with these kind of people? And still uses words like chosen, elect, beloved. Aren't you glad to hear that? Now, Reuben is going to object, but I actually like to read between the lines just a little bit here. Could they, despite themselves, despite their plans, despite their desires, could they have actually killed Joseph at this point?
No.
So here you also see them wanting to do something, desiring to kill him, And yet, because of who he is, and because of how he's going to play in God's larger divine plan to fulfill all the promises he made to Abraham, he cannot be killed. Joseph cannot die at this point. So you see God even entering into the evil, wicked plans of men and stopping them from doing the very thing they intend to do. And then God got really lucky because there were some traveling merchants who just happened to go by where the pit was, who just happened to be going to Egypt, which just happens to be the very place God intends to take the 12. God is so lucky. That takes us to verse 21. But Reuben heard this plan, and he rescued him, Joseph, out of their hands, and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So Reuben's plan, because he's the eldest, he's the oldest boy, so his plan is throw him in the pit. At least then he knows where he is. He's in the pit. And then his plan is to talk to his brothers and somehow secret Joseph off to his father. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored coat that was on him, and they took him and they threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty and without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. Isn't that an interesting little thing Moses took the time to add? I mean, what an interesting conscience these men had. That they could throw their brother into a pit after plotting his murder, ripping off his coat, and then, hey, lunch. They sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, and they were on their way down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. That's a really interesting phrase because it included, let's not kill him, he's our brother. But it also included, what profit is there in killing him? Let's sell him. That's a much more profitable enterprise. So it had the sense of, we're doing the right thing here. Let's not shed his blood. But it's also, we'll sell him. That's a good plan. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Verse 28. Now some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up. And they lifted Joseph out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments. That's a sign of grief among the Israelites, among the Jews, still a Middle Eastern practice, ripping your clothes to show grief. So he tore his garments. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, they slaughtered a male goat, they dipped the tunic in the blood, and they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether this is your son's tunic or not." Then Jacob examined it and said, "It is my son's coat. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." If you're a dad, you ought to be able to feel the pain in that statement. Notice they did not come and say, this is how treacherous these boys are. They did not come and say, "Hey, Dad, Joseph's dead." They came back and said, "Hey, Dad, look what we found. We found this multicolored coat. Is there any chance this is Joseph's coat?" They don't even mention the, "Oh, and it's covered in blood," which they did. They are being so conniving and surreptitious here that they take the coat to Dad and say, "Is there any chance this is Joseph's coat?" Like, "Oh, we never even got a chance to see him. He never even caught up with us. We were just walking and we found this and we brought it to you to see if maybe this is..." And Dad says, this is it. He's been torn apart by animals. They let their father come to that conclusion by giving him fake evidence. And none of them ever told Dad the truth. From that point forward, they kept the conspiracy alive. These are not good guys. He examined it and he said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob tore his clothes. He put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, surely I will go down to Sheol, or down into the grave, mourning for my son. In other words, he said, I'll never get over this. And they, the ones who were responsible for the treachery, tried to comfort him. You know, all they had to do was say, wait a minute, Dad, wait, I can't take the mourning. I can't take the pain we are causing you. It turns out, Dad, he's alive. We sold him. He's probably in Egypt somewhere, but he's alive. He's not torn apart by animals. None of them told him, while at the same time they tried to comfort him. These are not good guys.
Hey, Jim.
Yes.
New Geneva Study Bible says, note the irony of these verses. Having deceived his father, Isaac, with goat skins and with Esau's clothing,
yep.
Jacob here is deceived by goat blood on his son's clothes.
Yep.
So it kind of came back to
that. Yeah, the deception keeps going, generation to generation. But again, it makes the same point over and over. Look at the kind of men we're dealing with here. We are not dealing with people that would cause God to say, well, I choose them because they're the good ones. I choose the 12 tribes of Israel because they're the righteous ones, the God-fearing, upright, honest ones. These are all treacherous people. So he said, I will go down into my grave mourning for my son. So his father wept for Joseph. And meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So Joseph is now a slave in the house of an Egyptian governor. And then Moses just takes this hard left turn and introduces us to the story of Judah. Now, I have to tell you, because there are young boys and girls in the room, this is one of the more difficult passages in the book of Genesis because it does have to do with sexual relations and right sexual relations and wrong sexual relations. So I am going to walk through this as honestly and as gingerly as I can and try not to offend anybody. But at the same time, it's in the Bible, so we're going to deal with the text. What you need to know is that there was a standard set by this time where if a man had several sons, the eldest son would get married first naturally, but if he died without producing an heir, then the father of the sons would not have the next generation of male heirs to carry on his name, which means he would not have the next generation of male heirs to possess his land and have all his inheritance. So it's very important to have a male heir. So if the eldest son took a wife and then died before he produced an heir, the next oldest son was required to take that wife as his own wife and produce a male heir. But it wasn't considered his son. It was considered his elder brother's son. So that boy would get all the inheritance that belonged to the dad. That's how important this right of firstborn was. And so that's the heart of the story we're about to read, having to do with Judah and his sons. It came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in to her. So he took her as wife. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Then she conceived again, bore a son, and named him Onan. And she bore still another son, and named him Shelah, and it was at Chezeb. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord killed him. Now, we don't know anything more about that story. All Moses tells us is Judah's firstborn eldest boy was so bad. Now, remember, this is Judah who was conspiring to the, let's kill Joseph, let's sell Joseph. Apparently, his son after him was so much worse than that that even God went, oh, I can't let this continue, and killed him. Now, by the way, I also like the juxtaposition that Moses has created here between the 11 sons wanting to kill Joseph and not being able to, and God killing Ur. I mean, this is God saying, this one lives, this one doesn't. This one serves my function and purpose, this one doesn't. This is sovereignty at work. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. And Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Verse 8. Then Judah said to Onan, the second oldest, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother so that there would be a male heir to the firstborn who would have the inheritance. Onan, meanwhile, is such a good guy that he decides not to follow his father's instructions because he realizes that if he produces a child with Tamar, it won't be his child. It'll be his brother Ur's child. And Ur was probably a bad guy to pretty much everybody. It appears that Onan has no great love for Ur and doesn't really want to see a son come up to Ur, and so he is not going to complete the act. And Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so God killed him. Two for three now. Judah's raising some good boys, isn't he? Good old Judah. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, I am afraid that he too might die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. So now he's taken this daughter-in-law that two of his sons have been with and has said, rather than stay here in my house, I have some significant substance here, but instead, why don't you go back to your dad's house and let him take care of you? And someday when my youngest boy grows up, I'll send for you and, you know, he'll take care of the whole child thing. But he was more afraid that his youngest boy was going to die too, so he said, let's just get rid of the woman. We'll just get rid of Tamar. Now, this was tremendously unfair to Tamar, who was, for lack of a better word, innocent in all this. She was the one this was all being done to, but so far she was not complicit in any of it. And so, verse 11, Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house, not here, don't stay with us, until my son Shelah grows up, for he thought, I am afraid that he too might die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died, and when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garments. She covered herself with a veil. She wrapped herself and she sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. So she realizes now that this treacherous family is continuing their standard treachery And all these promises have been made to her. Now remember, if she does produce an heir, then that heir is going to take care of her in her old age. She gets Judah's inheritance, which is a significant inheritance. But because neither of the boys produced an heir, she's been cast out of the house. Go back to your father's house and just wait. Wait till Shelah's grown. The whole time Shelah is growing, she's wearing her widow's garments, making it clear that she's a widow. She hasn't taken any other husband. She's waiting for Judah to keep his word, and Judah's not doing it. And so she decides when she hears that Judah's going to be traveling that she's going to go dress up like a prostitute. And she's going to wait in the gate and see if she can't entice Judah. So forget the sons, I'm going after Dad now. That's the story. By the way, the story gets worse. What tribe did Jesus come out of?
Judah.
These are his progenitors. This is the lineage. When we talk about the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, Tamar's in there. Judah and Tamar are going to produce the heir that is going to continue the seed that gets all the way to the production of Christ on earth. Again, really evil people doing really evil things. Really bad stuff. Bad enough that God would kill you over it. She's going to go play the prostitute so that she can entice her father-in-law. And she's going to have a child out of that. This is not good stuff. But God's going to enter into it and produce the seed that leads to the lineage of Jesus himself. I'm glad to know that Jesus was not put off by or afraid or ashamed, that he was willing to come into a family line like that, because later he brought me into his family. And I fit. I fit right in with the heritage. So she dressed up. Verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. Women sitting in the gate with a veil over their face, so that you wouldn't know who they were typically acting as harlots. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Hear now, let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me if I let you come in with me?" So she's working the harlot deal. I need to get paid for this. What will you give me? And he said, "I will send you a kid from the flock." That's decent payment. I'll send you an animal. It'll produce milk. It'll produce meat. Reasonable payment. And she said, "Moreover, but will you give me a pledge until you send it?" Oh, she's a clever businesswoman. It's easy for some stranger to come walking by and say, "I'll send you a kid from the flock." And she says, "No, I'm going to need something. I'm going to need a pledge. I'm going to need you to leave something here with me. And then when you send somebody with the kid from your flock, then I'll give you back your pledge and he'll bring it home to you. I need a down payment. I need some surety. I need some insurance. I need a guarantee." He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her, and he went into her, and she became pregnant by him. So the seal was probably a ring. What do your other translations have there?
Signet.
The seal, the cord, the staff.
Signet, bracelet.
Right, ring, bracelet, walking staff. Now these are things that would identify him as being him. She could take this to any court of law and say, "This is the father. I have his signet ring, I have his bracelet, I have his staff. How would I get these if he hadn't given them to me?" She became pregnant. Verse 19. She arose and departed and removed her veil and put back on her widow's garments. When Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he could not find her because she was no longer sitting in the gate acting as a harlot. She had gone back to being Tamar the widow, so nobody in town knew who she was. And he asked the men of the place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim?" And they said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." Da 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 da. A mystery. Where'd she go? By the way, you have to read the white spaces between the lines to see the da 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 da. So he returned to Judah and he said, "I did not find her." And furthermore, the men of the place said, "There hasn't been a temple prostitute here." Okay, now he's lost his ring, his bracelet, and his walking staff. To a woman no one can find, and these things all prove that he was with a prostitute. We could not find her. Verse 24, now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. And behold, she is also with child by harlotry." In other words, after a few months go by, she's obviously pregnant. But she's also a widow. She's been walking around wearing widow's clothes, which means that she has been having sex, though not married. And so they immediately come to him and say, "Oh, you're not going to believe what that horrible Tamar's done. That woman has obviously been playing the harlot to make money because she's pregnant. Pregnant by her harlotry." And righteous Judah says, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Da 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 da. Judah, the one who, you know, was handing out rings and jewelry and bracelets and walking sticks to harlots, finds out that Tamar has played the harlot. She needs to burn. And he's the one who's like, "Here, bring the kid of the goat and pay my bill over there." He's okay when he does it. But if she does it, wrong. It's very similar, I think, to the story that is in the Gospel of John of the woman who's brought before Jesus who was caught in the act of adultery. And do you remember what the Jews said? They were all upset and they said, "We caught her in the very act." Which is really interesting because I want to know how they caught her in the very act. Where exactly were you and what were you doing when you caught her in the very act? And oh yeah, where's the guy? Because if you caught her in the very act, you were clearly peeking through windows or something. I mean, how did you find her? But all the men, because only men could attend stonings, so all the men are going, "Stone her, kill her." And nobody seems to have gone, "And the guy too." So this double standard is running very heavy here. Burn Tamar. And it's Judah saying it, even though he's the one that's already been to the prostitute. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law saying, "I am with child by the man to whom these things belong." And she sends the ring and the bracelet and the walking staff and says, "This is the father of my child." You can imagine his chagrin when his servants walk in and say, "Whoever this stuff belongs to, that's the one that has been with your daughter-in-law, the harlot." And she said, "Please examine and see whose signet ring, whose cords, whose staff are these?" And Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I." Right there, there's a silent, duh. "Inasmuch as I have not, I did not give her my son, Shelah, and he did not have relations with her ever again." And it came about at the time that she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place that while she was giving birth, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread onto his hand, saying, "This one came out first." Right of firstborn. This is all about who's the firstborn, who gets the inheritance, who gets everything that Judah has. So one baby's hand came out first, and the midwife was very quick to tie a scarlet thread onto his hand so they'd always be able to identify the firstborn baby, regardless of what order they came out with. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." And so he was named Perez, which means breached. Yeah. And afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. Zerah and Perez become the next generation of Judah Heights in the continuing seed that's going to lead to Christ. Now, this is a bad story. It's an ugly story. Let's admit it. There's a lot of ugliness in that chapter. There's a lot of stuff going on there that just makes us all go, ooh. It's just a creepy story. But God entered into that ugliness and that creepiness to work his ultimate good. The line of Judah could not end at Judah. There had to be an heir. And the two eldest boys of Judah were so bad, God killed them. And Judah wasn't going to let his youngest son go produce an heir with Tamar. But an heir had to be produced, and so God enters into the really sinful act of her playing a harlot, Judah going in to visit a harlot, him wanting to burn his daughter-in-law when he finds out about it, and then coming to the realization that he had wronged her the whole time, and then she produces twins. The lineage continues. Christ is going to come through that lineage. That's a really good thing that happens. But it came out of really bad circumstances. You understand? Mm-hmm. See, I'm sure that when the news came out, hey, Ur's dead. Really? How'd he die? Just dead. God killed him. Dead. That's bad news. That had to be really sad. And I'm sure that at that moment, Judah had a lot of thoughts about, well, where's this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob right now? Where's God in all this? So then he sends Onan in and says, produce an heir for me. Raise up an heir to your brother. We need an heir here. We got to keep the family going. And Onan does what he does, and God kills him. I can only imagine that at that point, Judah, it's no wonder that he grabbed the third boy and said, get away from Tamar. You know, the first two went to her and they're both dead. So let's just send her to dad's house and protect the young boy. All of that's really bad, and I'm sure that Judah got real confused about where's God in all this. But was God there the whole time?
Sure.
Yeah, it was God that was busy killing people. It was God who entered into these evil things and brought about his ultimate good, the twin boys who are going to produce the lineage that leads to Christ. That's really, really good. And it comes from really, really bad. Are you getting a sense for what I'm saying tonight? Because I'm really only saying one thing. Moses jammed those two stories against each other. First, Joseph's brothers wanting to kill him, selling him into slavery, which is going to produce many people kept alive. They meant it for evil. God meant it for good. And then right against that, he jams up the story of Judah and Tamar and Onan, that whole story. And really bad stuff happens, but we who know the rest of the story know all the good that comes from it. You only have to get to Jacob in his old age, blessing his 12 sons. Jacob is going to turn to Judah and say that Judah is a lion's whelp, but that law-giving, the scepter, is not going to depart from Judah till Shiloh comes, whose right it is to reign. That promise is going to be put on Judah's head. Judah, this guy, this bad guy. Nevertheless, Jacob is going to prophesy that it's through him that Messiah is coming. So God enters into really treacherous lives and really bad circumstances and works his ultimate good because he really is that sovereign. And when I use words like sovereign, I'm not just saying sovereign in that he picks and chooses, sovereign in that he elects, sovereign in that he does whatever he wants to do sitting on his throne, but it's also sovereign enough that the evil intention and will of men can't upset his plan. He's still working his ultimate good, and the culmination of the world is going to happen exactly the way he intends for it to happen, and every knee is going to bow, and every tongue is going to confess that Jesus is Lord. All the stuff we've been talking about on Sunday mornings, that stuff is inescapable. It's going to happen because it's all in the hand of a sovereign God who is using evil, wicked people to accomplish his ultimate superior good. Got that? And that's all in Genesis! I don't have to go far into the Bible to get my theology about an absolutely sovereign God who works in the affairs of human beings to do whatever pleases him. Now we can stop right there, and next week we'll pick up at chapter 39, and that'll be the beginning of Joseph. All of a sudden it's, oh yeah, remember I mentioned Joseph at Potiphar's house? Moses jumps back to that story then and says, okay, now that I told you that whole Judah thing, let's go back to Joseph, and you're going to hear the Potiphar story, and right away Joseph is going to be accused of rape. So the story doesn't get better right away. By the way, he's innocent, but he's going to get accused. And he's going to end up in prison. So it's going to be yet another account of people who could rightly say, where's God? And again, you're going to see God right in the middle of it, keeping many people alive. Questions about that? Yes, ma'am.
Is every act of immorality a part of God's sovereign plan?
I would be careful about saying that acts of immorality are God's sovereign plan. What I would say is that God works his plan despite and through the action activity of people. But you have to be careful that you don't charge God with sin. You can't be saying, well, God is the author of all these sinful things that happen. That's why the concept of compatibilism is so important, is that it says that the evil actions, wills, and intentions of human beings aren't in conflict with the will and plan of God. God works his plan and will despite these circumstances and sometimes through these circumstances. But you can't ever charge God with evil. James is real clear about that and says, you know, God never tempts any man to do evil. So you can't ever charge God with being the author of the evil that happens. Instead, the evil that happens, God is not thwarted by the evil that happens. He works despite the evil and sometimes works through the evil, but the evil is still the responsibility of the people who did it. Did that answer your question? Okay. Anything else? That was a really good question, by the way. I'm glad you asked that. It gave me an opportunity to clear that up. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
So, if... it's a hard question because it's bordering on that free will thing.
Right, sure.
Does Judah believe?
Believe what?
In God, then?
Yeah, I'm sure he believes God exists.
Exists, but not necessarily a believer.
God's been killing a couple of his boys. He's got a lot of evidence that God exists.
Yeah, right, but I mean... Yeah. You know, big... can of worms, but...
No, it's okay. I'm actually... The reason I'm pulling you out is that I want you to keep going down that line of thinking.
So Judah has done all these horrible things. Mm-hmm. Christ does come through the lineage, which mm-hmm. proves that God can do whatever he wants
right.
despite yeah. our own worst intentions.
Right.
But
why does Christ come through Judah's lineage?
Well, because he said he would.
Yeah, God chose him. Right. Yeah. So now... God chose him and uses Jacob before he dies to even say so. So did God choose him because he was good?
No.
No, so why did God choose?
Because he wanted to.
Sovereign election. Yeah.
Okay.
God chooses to do whatever he wants to do. We've been seeing this all the way through the book of Genesis. It's why Paul picks it up in Romans 8 and 9 and uses Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, as evidence of God's election. He even says it right there, so that God's purpose according to election would stand. Paul sees God's sovereign election all the way through Genesis and is real clear to point that out. So why Judah? Moses is real clear to say, not a good guy, and nevertheless, through him Christ is going to come. Sovereign election works, not based on works, not based on merit, but on God that shows mercy. Huh? And that principle is all the way through the Bible. It never changes because God doesn't change. So the principle is consistent. Yes, ma'am.
Could Judah have chosen not to do the wicked act?
You know what? That kind of speculation, could he have chosen to do this? Could he have chosen to do that? I think is immaterial because what we know is he did it. And he did it and God chose him anyway. And God used him anyway. So if we're going to go down the road of... what if this had happened? What if they hadn't thrown Joseph in the pit? They wouldn't have ended up in Egypt, so they wouldn't have been there as slaves, so then they wouldn't have come back to the promised land. Would God's plan have been thwarted? Well, all of that speculation accomplishes nothing because what the Bible says is it all did happen. And so I would argue that history is in the hands of an absolutely sovereign God who is telling us, sometimes past tense, like Moses is doing here, sometimes in advance, like Isaiah does, exactly what's going to happen so that we can rest in the fact that whatever happens is in accordance with God's will. But to speculate about the what-ifs doesn't accomplish anything. Instead, what we know is this did happen.
There's one line of reasoning that says, life is like a chess match. Mm-hmm. You know, we make a move, God makes a move. We make a move, God makes a move. Yeah. And God always has an infinite number of ways to get back to what he wants to have happen. What do you think about that?
I disagree. If I were going to use the imagery of chess to describe the relationship between man and God, I would say that God has the white side, and he makes the first move, and it's checkmate, game over. I don't like the chess analogy because that implies that God is actually competing with us or that we're competing with him. You don't find anything in the Bible to substantiate that, just nothing. There's just nowhere in the Bible to get that idea. Instead, what you see is what I've been really stressing tonight, God's in control anyway. Yes, this stuff happens, and God's in control anyway.
If it is a chess match, we can't even move without his help.
Right, exactly. We wouldn't know what the next move was. Exactly. So the whole chess analogy kind of falls apart.
But we don't even qualify the player on the other side of the board.
Yeah, exactly.
Or
yeah.
Maybe the pieces on the board.
Now we may be chess pieces being moved around on the board. That one I'll give you. Yes, Elizabeth.
I just kind of have a question, you know, about Tamar's twins.
Uh-huh.
Did they get all of Judah's wealth since that was the son of the firstborn?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So miraculous about Jesus' bloodline is something so good coming out of something that was so bad. So, I mean, first...
Yeah, you know...
That makes it even more fabulous.
That's what I love about reading the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, is that if you read through them and you look at the list of people, mm-hmm. it makes you kind of go, wow, you know, what kind of pedigree is this, Jesus? Mm-hmm. It's not the rich and powerful and the kings of the earth. It's these kind of folks.
Human folks.
Yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay, so Josh, did I circumlocute all of the difficult passages there comfortably enough, or did I make you squirm at any point tonight? No squirming? Okay, that's good. What about you? Was there any point where you kind of went, oh, creepy? That was my impression of you. Oh, creepy. Was that close? No? Okay, good.
I do think that maybe we've arrived at the next little quotation on the next precious moments figuring.
Oh, dear.
That God can bring good things out of your dysfunctional family, too.
Yes. Yes, there we go. Put it into production. I'll help you move them.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.